Good day, everybody, and welcome to another jam-packed episode of the Michael and Patty Show, coming to you live from the Charlottetown waterfront, where we've had our first touch of snow, which is certainly all melted away at this moment. Patty, welcome aboard.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for another great opportunity to share some of our insight and wisdom with our listeners.
Well, thanks for showing up. I'm looking at the statistics for October 2024. And every time I look at these stats, I think to myself, it doesn't feel right. When I drive around, a lot of people ask, what's the market like? Well, all you need to do is drive around. You can see what the market's like because you can see the for sale signs are up a lot longer and you're starting to see price reduced signs and you're starting to see people doing massive price reductions in the hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. But when you look at the stats, everything looks all just super rosy. But again, the problem that we have here is we don't have huge numbers. The province is only, what, 172,000 people?
Yeah, approximately that.
When you have, you look at duplex sales and there's two sales versus one sale last year, you know, things have gone up by 100%. Regardless of that, our stats are saying home sales are up 45.6%. What a huge number. People cannot buy property fast enough on the island. But when you look at the numbers, home sales number 214 in October 2024, up 45.6% compared to 147 units in October 2023. What does that mean? I mean, you could look at other last month, and maybe everyone moved their closing into October from September, whatever, right?
Yeah, last year, though, we did hit a little bit of a lull. Things were quiet, and it was coming out of the 2021-2022 hot market that we had with after the pandemic. And I feel last year was about recovering, resetting. Interest rates were high. Consumers were not confident. Everybody put the brakes on. There wasn't a lot of activity happening. This year, I do find that we're getting back to a little bit of a normalcy. We don't have a hot market. This doesn't indicate, which some would assume, oh, you know, home sales up 45.6%. That must mean the market's better. We're just starting to actually recover, reset, and start to have a market again.
A normalized market.
Correct.
New listings are up 5.8%. There was 292 new listings added in October 2024, up 5.8% compared to 276 lististings in October 2023.
So what does that tell you, Michael?
That tells me that there's 5.8% more listings.
Well, what it tells me, my interpretation of this data, is many sellers had, again, not only buyers putting on the brakes because of interest rates, but a lot of sellers were also not bringing their property or not going to make the move because they had nowhere to go. And as inventory starts to slowly go up, sellers are becoming more confident, feeling like they may have some options for their next move. So that's why you're seeing listing inventory going up now.
Market is balanced, which basically weighs buyers against sellers. It's saying at the end of October, the market was balanced but tilted in favor of sellers. So the sellers still have a very small advantage, but don't let it go to your head.
Yes, exactly.
And when I say that, well, I'll get into a story here next, and we'll just finish this off before that. Benchmark price. So the benchmark for what is it called? The HPI, Home Price Index.
Correct.
Is supposed to be the atypical house in PEI. And the benchmark price was $375,600 in 2024. This is up 1.6% from $369,600 in October 2023. If you were to index that with inflation, I don't know where inflation is today, but I'm guessing it's over 1.6%, you could say prices have actually gone down.
Depending on what inflation rate is, yes, absolutely.
Well, they usually have a target of 2%, and I think we're over that. But unfortunately, I probably know more about the U.S. financial markets than the Canadian markets.
And just know that the number, like the 375, 376,000 average price, that's taken the entire residential market from tip to tip. And that's taking the average for that. This isn't just a localized Charlottetown or Summerside, Montague market averages. This is the entire island.
If you subscribe to my mailing list, and I'm not sure if you send it out, I do email out the complete statistical packages. There's two of them. One is sort of condensed, and the other one's about 80 some odd pages, which breaks everything down if you're into numbers. So just be sure to join my newsletter on my website. Do you send that out?
Yeah, we do that on request. We don't want to inundate people with too much information, especially those who maybe those are not into numbers. We do quarterly stats and annual stats at my office, my brokerage, which gives you far more detail than this as well. It gives you days on market. What was the average list price? What was the average sale price? What are properties selling for on average list to sale? So is there 2% negotiating wiggle on, you know, room on average, or is it, you know, 5 or 6%? So those are the stats that we have.
I try to limit the amount of emails in my newsletter recipients to no more than 100 a week.
Okay.
I just want to keep them all top of mind and keep reading. So I was talking to my father, which I know, in fact, will never be listening to this podcast. He lives in Ontario, and he's completely anti-technology. And he's, you know, your typical senior living in a house all alone. Maybe you've got a spouse, if you're lucky enough. You know, no income other than his pension or whatever, which probably doesn't add up to a lot. And then, you know, Patty one day mentions she goes to this seminar on reverse mortgages, which I always thought were kind of scammy. And I would still caution people to make sure you know what you're signing into. But when I look at my father sitting in a house that's worth X number of dollars, I automatically think, like, why wouldn't you pull that equity out and buy an apartment building or something and at least have some income rather than sitting on this asset that's producing nothing other than asset appreciation if, you know, in fact, that value is going up. And depending on how much deferred maintenance there is, you know, there could be some expenses there as well. However, the challenge is if you are a senior and you have no real income from a job or a business or whatever the case may be, access to credit can become very difficult. So it's not as easy as it would be for Patty or I or someone that's employed with a consistent income to go borrow money to buy a multifamily unit or whatever the case may be. So Patty mentioned a reverse mortgage. Why don't you tell us everything you know about reverse mortgages in less than 20 seconds?
I will do my best to give a very condensed version of a reverse mortgage. So a reverse mortgage is for seniors 55 and up in Canada who have a paid off, there's no mortgage owing on their primary residence, and that's where they need to be residing, is obviously in this primary residence. They can borrow as much as like up to 55%. Again, there are conditions that, you know, the lender would end up putting into place. However, it is up to 55% of your property value. So they would send out an appraiser to establish what that number looks like. And then what they do is, it exactly as the title is, reverse mortgage, instead of you paying in mortgage payments, you're creating a mortgage by them paying you based on the equity. So that one day when you do go to sell your property, obviously out of the proceeds of the sale, you're paying back this mortgage. So the people that this would benefit from is if you don't have children, and where is your money going? You know, when you sell, even if you have children and you don't want to give them the money, you could do a reverse mortgage, do some home repairs, maybe take some trips, allow your life, your quality of life to be improved instead of, like Michael said, living on your pension check, which is very minimal because I know that's how my mother lives. And everything is so tight. This would allow a little bit of freedom, a little bit of being able to go out for breakfast, maybe, you know, at a nicer restaurant, instead of eating toast and tea at home all the time. It gives them a little bit of a freedom and a nicer quality of life, I guess I said. So that's basically what a reverse mortgage is. There are two government approved. I know Michael and I had a big discussion over this, over who would provide a reverse mortgage, but there are two main ones that are government approved, and that would be the direction I would recommend, because like you said, Michael, there are perhaps some scammers and some concerns. You just don't want to get yourself into a bad situation.
What I would suggest you do if you are looking at this is definitely talk to your accountant or a CPA of some form. And I'd also talk to your lawyer to review any documents you're signing and don't step into this blind. Patty mentioned there's two companies that do this nationally that are approved by the Canadian government. There's also a number of mortgage brokers that would offer this, and I can't see any reason why Joe Blow couldn't do the same thing. And that was our discussion, which I accept your apology for being wrong.
Well, the training course that I had taken on reverse mortgages, which was a new concept,
It's been around since the 80s.
Yes, that's information that I have provided and shared with you.
No, I knew that before. You never shared anything with me. Okay. It was called the CHIP mortgage.
Yes.
Canadian Home Income Program? I'm just making that up. I just assume that's what
pretty much that's what it stood for.
I remember there were some really dorky commercials they had. You remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, so probably on YouTube.
Well, it is an option for listeners who are in the senior age bracket and you're trying to financially plan. Maybe you don't want to leave your home and have to downsize. Maybe you don't want to say you have $1 million home or a $500,000 home. Who are you going to leave the funds to? Why not you enjoy the funds and improve your quality of life by doing a reverse mortgage and, just having a better day?
It's time for our segment of the show called Stupid Things Homeowners Do When They're Selling Their House.
Okay.
Tell me your story about insurance. And if I sell my house and the closing date is on November 12th, immediately I need to phone the insurance company and tell them to cancel the policy that day, don't I?
No. So most insurance companies are good, and you can confirm this. Most insurance companies will say you just have to call us on the day that your property has closed, not when it's closing, because a lot of opportunity for things to go sideways. Lenders don't have the funds in place. Lawyers, it took too long to get an agreement based on maybe some deficiencies or disagreements from the final walkthrough. So wait until it actually is closed and you've got that call from your lawyer saying it's closed, it's official. Call your insurance company. It's very easy for them to basically flip this switch and your policy is done. If you do have insurance and it's coming up to be expired or renewed and your closing is still a couple weeks or a month or two later, please renew your insurance.
What about vacant houses? Because you're selling the house, grandma was in there, they've carted her off to the old age home, now the house is sitting there vacant.
Or grandpa. Well, you just need to know that the insurance
grandpa's
is
probably
go up.
By now.
Okay. You need insurance, or you should. Best practice, especially if you have a mortgage, it's a requirement of your financing. But if there's no mortgage, you do have the option of going, well, I'm not going to insure it. However, in our agreement of purchase and sales, it does say that the seller agrees to have insurance as the proceeds, the buyer's interest is present up until closing date. So it is the seller's responsibility when they enter into a contractual agreement to make sure that...
Bottom line is don't cancel your insurance until it's closed and the check is in your hand. That's the bottom line. We've run into instances before where people canceled their insurance. The house is sitting there vacant. Anything could happen. The other thing is be honest with your insurance company. If the house is sitting there vacant, tell them it's vacant. You're probably going to pay more. But at the end of the day, the insurance companies aren't stupid. They know that if the house burns to the ground and they send an investigator out there, there's no furniture to be found anywhere. It was probably vacant. And they're going to talk to your neighbors. They're going to say it's vacant. So just make sure a proper insurance policy is in place. And what about the, just in closing, so we don't belabor this subject, these people that say, oh, I'm just going to set up a kitchen table and a bed in the house, and that will fool the insurance company. I don't think so.
Insurance companies do send people out to check on properties. I know firsthand because I've had clients tell me that. So
okay.
Mindful.
What's involved in closing a property? You thought this would be a good topic?
It is a good topic.
So you're complimenting yourself.
It is one that I guess I am. It is one that I don't think people fully understand everything that's involved. And it's best, in my opinion, to be as informed as possible, especially if you have a newer agent representing you, regardless of what side of the transaction you're on, things can get missed, which can make closing not smooth. Part of the closing of a property, a couple weeks prior to, you should be having things like your oil top up or fuel adjustments, because unless it's waived within your contract agreement, seller's responsible for topping up fuel and the buyer's responsible again, unless there's something different in your contract agreement, for compensating the seller for a full tank. Maritime Electric here on the island, for most parts, City of Summerside, for electricity in Summerside, you will be responsible for disconnecting your services, buyers responsible for hookup. So these are all things that you get in place prior to. Make sure you have an insurance certificate. Even though the insurance company has approved your insurance during your home and your insurance inspection, part of your transaction in the early days, make sure you contact them so that the insurance certificate is at the lawyer's office, because it's a requirement of your financing. We're on closing day now. Typically, my best practice is to do a final walkthrough the morning of. I know some will do them a day or two before.
Well, it'll be in the contract when you're supposed to do your pre-close, technically.
Most, if you are a buyer, you're trusting the agent. I'm just only speaking from mine. The reason I pick the morning of at 9 a.m. is typically my final walkthrough day, is because if the keys are being transferred sometime around probably 4 or 5 o'clock that night, I don't want a house sitting vacant for too long or having issues happen in the winter months, pipes freezing. I want no surprises. So I would like to know by 10 a.m. the house is locked up and my buyers are going to be the next people to turn that key and walk into the door sometime in the late afternoon, evening. Less chance for any issues to arise. Your final walkthrough consists of going through the home, and as much as it's exciting, and I allow the excitement obviously to happen, but I also want to protect my clients, my buyer clients, is the side I'm speaking of right now. You want to make sure that you're there to do a serious task. There are hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases millions of dollars, being transacted on this day, transferred hands. You want to make sure that you know exactly what you're getting into. The home meets, you know, your expectations. There is no new damage, no surprises, and that everything is in place. So my spiel that I always tell my clients when it is final walkthrough is, okay, we have a job to do. Today we're going through the home, making sure it's in the condition that you agreed to purchase it in. Make sure there's no new, you know, damage or deficiencies within the home. Make sure if appliances are included that they all work, and make sure there's not a lot of like debris or garbage. And again, our best practice is the property's wiped clean. Anything that is not what you've expected, usually your agent will take pictures, send them off to your lawyer, and then between the lawyers, they'll have a conversation and see how they can resolve issues. Take pictures of the valve tank and that.
You want to make sure that everything complies with the purchase and sale agreement, in that anything that was included should be there. Pardon me?
And any repairs as well that needed to be done, that they have been completed.
Right. So you're going to bring your contract with them. And Patty even goes a step further and tests her appliances.
I do test all the appliances. So as a seller, again, it's just a reverse of everything, but your property should be wiped clean. You shouldn't be leaving paint cans and that behind unless you've got permission. I have been at final walkthroughs where buyers are saying, I don't want any of these paint cans. And it just creates a little bit of challenge for the day, where people are running around now trying to remove, you know, items that weren't supposed to be left behind.
Next subject.
Okay, Michael.
When you're representing buyers, would you ever tell them not to buy a house, that particular house you're looking at, to be more concise?
That depends.
Yes or no?
No, I would never tell a buyer not to buy a house.
Why not?
Because in my opinion, it is not, I'm not the one buying it. I have to listen to their needs and find out. If they're asking me my opinion, I'll give them my professional opinion based on resale, condition, how the price aligns with the product that we're looking at. Those are the main components that I would be advising on. I'm curious as to where you're going with this.
I would tell them not to buy the house. And if they still buy it, it's up to them. But at the end of the day, hopefully, if they're serviced properly, they're going to come back to me to sell that house. And if that house is not a viable product to begin with, I don't want to be stuck with the listing and then having to explain to those clients they bought 11 and there's 12 different reasons why. Be honest with them. If they want to, if still want to buy it, all the power to them. But if I walk into that house and I see it's bad electrical, the basement's leaking, it's a block foundation, there's a view of a cemetery in the backyard, there's disposal of toxic waste in the side yard, and the driveway's cracking, the roof's about to cave in, there's all kinds of problems with it, I'm probably going to tell them not to buy that house. If they want that as an endeavor, or they want to take it on as a project, so be it. But I don't want to be responsible for selling someone a house that I know is going to be problematic down the road when they sell. And of course, a lot of people, how many times have you heard, I'm not selling this house, we're going to die in this house, and then 2 years later, they're calling you to sell it. The circumstances have changed.
100%.
You should always, it's easy to get into real estate. The exit strategy is a little more difficult, and you should always consider when you're buying a property, how am I going to get out of this if life circumstances changed?
Yes, I agree with you. They need to be not so short or not long-sighted. They need to be a little short-sighted too. If life does go sideways, there's always health, you know, concerns, there's jobs, children are having grandbabies and now you don't want to be so far away, or you thought you were never going to get married and suddenly the love of your life after closing shows up at your doorstep. So there are lots of reasons why. I don't think any of us can make the statement that this is the house we're going to be in for the next 10, 20, 30 years. So I agree with you. However, just an interesting viewpoint. I will be honest, but I would never make a definitive statement like that, Michael.
Good job. What's your mindset on listing an overpriced property?
That's like
overpriced based on what the market says it's worth.
Yeah, that's there's two sides to that. So selfishly, you could take that listing as a listing agent to see if you could get that price down to where it needs to be. How flexible, how motivated are these sellers? And, you know, where did they get this number from, and how you know, positioned are they and locked into that number? As a listing agent, you may take that listing just, again, to get your sign. You might get other business in the area because sign marketing does work for the agent. However, the flip side of that is you could lose respect in the industry and people could just go, oh, it's that person. Yeah, he or she, they're known for listing overpriced properties. So every buyer that comes in to that home already has the mindset, the mentality that they're going to be negotiating the price down because you're known as overpriced listing agent.
An agent has two basic choices. They either accept an overpriced property and hopefully the vendor gets worn down and faces reality and reduces the price, but usually they don't and it expires and the vendor gets agitated with the listing agent because, of course, if the house isn't selling, it's always the listing agent's fault, not the market's. Or plan B is don't take overpriced listings to begin with, which is probably a better plan. But agents have more of a challenge doing that because the house will probably transact once the price is reduced. The biggest challenge, you know, within the past few years since 2016, 2017, is houses were selling way above what the market said they're worth. So agents have been very cautious in saying this is where the market is, because what happens is they list the house that the market says is worth 5 or 6, they list it for 9 and it sells for 9, and then, oh, wow, Patty didn't know what she was talking about. She told us it was worth 5 or 6. It wasn't Patty, it was the market. But the agent gets a reputation or gets bad mouth because they're just telling them reality. Just because someone buys an overpriced property, we have no control over that. All we can share is the actual data, which is what we should be doing.
Yeah, and that takes us back to the one we were just talking about telling a buyer not to buy the property. Because if you do end up purchasing this property, in the example, and I know which property that you're referring to, and Michael and I, about 5 years ago, went into a listing appointment that the property came in at around $700,000.
So it wasn't seven, it was like $450,000, and they wanted $1 million.
And they ended up picking an agent who told them what they wanted to hear. And because the market was so chaotic, they did get that price. Here's my point in this. That same now buyer who owns this property, life circumstances change and they need to sell that property, guess what? I don't want to be the agent that represented that sale if I never told that buyer client, you are overpaying for this property, because I don't want to be the one sitting at their kitchen table going, well, you kind of overpaid and probably by a few hundred thousand dollars. Here's where your property's worth. Chances are they're not going to say that. They're going to end up just telling you what you want to hear to preserve the relationship, to avoid the uncomfortable conversation, putting it on at that $1 million mark. And it's going to sit for 5+ years waiting, and the relationship's going to get severed. They're going to be on agent number 5 because they'll be switching agents every year just to rekindle the relationship, try to get the excitement there, because that's what sellers like to see and feel, is their agents really excited and enthusiastic about their overpriced listing, because that one's going to be the one that sells it.
They're looking for the, for lack of a better term, the bigger idiot marketing program. So you got one idiot that paid more than 100% for that house, or close to 100%. Now they're looking for someone that's a bigger idiot that's going to pay 150, 200% for that same house. Here's the good thing. I've been watching a number of listings here the last couple of months that I talked to before they even listed. And they all had that belief that we're going to put it on for some stupid number and someone is going to come along and buy it. And the one house I looked at, I figured 550, 600 on a good day. They paid 400 for it, you know, just a few years ago. Well, they figured it was worth 850 now. Well, they ended up putting it on for 8 and change, not to disclose the address. Next thing you know, 60 days later, it's down to 6 something. So the good thing is the market is starting to correct and people are becoming a lot more rational. And it's more and more important to look at the sales data than it ever has before. I know somebody else, another house I'm watching, they put it on at a big number, still sitting there three months later. Another house I'm looking at, again, worth 5, 6 on a good day, put it on for 850, it's still sitting. So you're seeing less and less of the bigger idiots buying these houses, because you're starting to see the markets correct, which is good, because now our market data will be much more accurate and viable, rather than everyone just making up prices and hoping it sells, which is really frustrating.
It has been frustrating. 2021, as much as it was a record high sale for residential properties, it impacted our market and the opportunity for, say, some of the younger generation to be able to get in, because the prices had they didn't make any sense. And the pandemic did some real damage, in my opinion. So hopefully 2025, things will have recovered and resetted enough that we would, if resetted is enough, is a word, to allow people to feel confident to enter into the real estate market once again.
On to another story about why buyer's agents like to put their buyers through an interview process to make sure they're viable buyers. Recently, there's been an instance where a particular person has been going around and writing offers through how many? 6, 10, 12 different agents?
There's a list.
And then she just, once the offer gets accepted, this person just ghosts them. What can be done to prevent this sort of thing?
That goes back to, and I know on one episode we had discussed the buyer's intake process and how sometimes buyers can become frustrated. I know working with me directly, I've had a few, not many, but I have had a few over the years where a buyer will say, I have to answer all these questions in order to get through and look at this property. The answer is yes. And here is a prime example as to why we go through that. I feel we call it ROM. I know you have a different acronym, but request office meeting every time.
CETO.
CETO?
CETO.
What is CETO?
Come into the office.
Okay.
That's from Floyd Wickman, one of the best real estate trainers ever.
I like to take my clients through a whole intake process. Usually I do it over phone because a lot of my buyers, you know, they may be out of province. We do Zoom. I have done Zoom conversation interviews with buyers, answering questions. I'm able to share my screen with them. We can look at properties together. But it is really important to do that. If you are able to meet with them in person at the office, an opportunity to collect their ID. You're going to need it for FinTrack anyways if this is a serious buyer. They're going to commit to you. You'll have far greater success on both sides for the agent investing their time as well as the buyer.
In an ideal world, the buyer should come into the office so you can discuss what their needs are. We should get a copy of their identification. We should find out who is going to be involved in that buying decision. We should get some proof of financing. In the States, it's very common, not so much in Canada, to actually show where the funds are coming from for both the deposit and the purchase. And that could be a printout from a bank statement or investment account. Some people find that it's intrusive, but I mean, this particular instance where this woman's running around writing offers here, there, and everywhere for entertainment purposes, is if she went through those processes to begin with, this wouldn't exist.
Yeah, and it created a lot of upset. I can't imagine the people, because one of the situations, there was a dominoes effect where the seller offered on another property, and you know, if they had provided their deposit, there's just so much chaos involved in this, and this one individual has disrupted so many people's lives, which then doesn't instill confidence in hiring a realtor, because you'd like to think that you're protected from some of this nonsense. So just, if you're an agent listening to this, please be mindful. It's okay to ask questions, and it's okay to walk away from a relationship if you don't feel that this person is allowing you to do your job and protect yourself and seller clients. Because the seller at the end of the day is who's listed with a realtor, listed with a brokerage. So they're trusting our industry. So we need to live up to what we've promised and what they've expected.
On another story, I recently sold a commercial property and the purchaser was dealing with, interestingly enough, a number of contact points, and none of them were very communicative. What do you think about that? I know what I think, and I told the other agent.
Well, you're going to have to give me a little bit more information, Michael.
Well, he had clients that were buying a commercial property. He would text one client, and they wouldn't return his text for 2, 3, 4 days. He had another client that he would email, and sometimes he'd get a response, sometimes he wouldn't, didn't have his phone number. So I said to that agent, in my opinion, you establish one point of communication. Would you agree?
I agree with that.
That one point of communication should be someone that is communicative. If they're going to play games and ignore texts and ignore phone calls and emails, and it takes you a week to turn anything around, then you need to have a conversation with them and tell them to get their stuff together. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would 100%.
Because I would never deal with that. I'd sooner just walk away from the deal than deal with that sort of nonsense. Because every time we have a question that we put in front of a buyer or seller, we try to get it off our desk as quickly as possible. We don't have a week to keep following up with one simple little question. With this particular transaction, ironically enough, they were asked a week and a half, 2 weeks prior to the close when they're going to do the pre-closing inspection. They indicated they weren't going to do one. And come closing day, they're like, well, we're going to do a pre-closing inspection. I said, no, you're not. I said, here's the documents that said you rejected that. We have no keys on site, so they'll probably take a few days to get here. So I think the other agent just told them, look through the windows. Everything's still there. But the point of the matter, this is an extremely rare circumstance where you get this sort of situation happening with pre-closes and non-communication. If you're going to be dealing with an agent, respond quickly so they can keep things moving along, because there's deadlines for all this stuff and everyone cannot be sitting around waiting 4 days for a response if they even get one. And if you don't have a phone number, you shouldn't be dealing with that person anyway.
Yeah, and by not responding, it's very easy for, I know speaking for myself, being a professional realtor in this business, every day there's all these fires that come at you. So by not responding in a timely manner to your agent, you run the risk of the agent. It's at the back of their mind now. They're on to other things. They're trying to put out new fires that should have been resolved on Monday. It's now Thursday, and now it's getting missed. So it doesn't allow for a very smooth real estate experience, and not a, in my opinion, teamwork working together.
Our final question.
Okay.
In PEI, I see a lot of cottages, and I think, geez, that would make a beautiful year-round home. It's on the water, it's private, it's secluded. Can I buy a cottage and live in it year-round?
I don't know if this is a trick question.
You stuttered.
I know, because I don't know where you're coming at, but I will say, Yes, you can live in a cottage year round if you have a heat source and it is insulated. You just may need to be responsible for snow removal because it may not be on a year round road.
What about restrictive and protective covenants that preclude that?
Oh, well, that's another. If the covenants say that you cannot reside because maybe they have a central water system in place, then no, you cannot reside there year round.
What if they chain off the entrance to the subdivision in November?
Unless you have a snowmobile, you're not getting to the property.
The bottom line is, regardless of whether you're here or anywhere else, a lot of these cottage subdivisions are traversing to luxury waterfront communities, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Lots of examples of that. When you get property subdivided, a lot of times you'll see on the survey for cottage use only. That doesn't necessarily mean it's for cottage use only. It basically means that the government is not going to provide waste watch or garbage collection or school services or whatever when it's not cottage season. That doesn't, in some cases, mean you can't use it year-round, providing physically it's equipped. You've got your own water source that's operational, electricity, road, all that sort of stuff. They don't gate off the entrance. This particular case, they're asking about a cottage that was on the water because they could buy this cottage for in and around $369. Where are you going to find a waterfront home for $369 a PEI?
Very, very slim chance.
It's going to be difficult. So these guys were thinking out of the box, which is what you should do if you're looking at properties. If you're looking for a waterfront home, go under the cottage category, which people looking for homes are going to overlook, and you may be able to find cottages that are or have year-round potential. Do you want to shut her down for us? This, by the way, this is a one-year anniversary come November 19th, which, according to my stats, is pretty good. We're still here.
Yes, we're still here, and I understand our listening audience is slowly growing. We appreciate everyone who checks in on our podcast, supports us. Some send us questions, some send us comments. We love comments. Please like our podcast. It's very important. Allows us to know that what we're doing every day is of value to you. Were you going to say something, Michael?
Yes, it's not Facebook. You can't like a podcast. You have to give it a star rating.
Star rating.
Give it feedback.
And feedback. Okay. Corrected. Thank you. Have a great day.
Patty's a professional liker. She spends all day liking people's posts. She does it at night, too.
Happy anniversary, Michael. Hopefully we will be here and celebrating our second anniversary of the Michael and Patty Show. Have a great day, and until next time.
Bye for now.